fly up there periodically to go to USIS, or what became JustBot, and get films to show students at the high school. It was during that time that I was involved with this Volunteers in Service to Vietnam thing. And it may be they just needed somebody to do I-Corps. I don't know.
Well, why would they... I mean, in that you were in Bung Tao and I-Corps is at the other end of the country. Do you...
Why?
Yes.
I can't explain it to you.
Well, maybe we'll find some correspondence which will...
Well, I don't know if I have correspondence about it. It's possible. Yeah, maybe Don.
Don might even remember.
Yeah.
And did you have any reflections on, I mean, people speak a great deal of regionalism in Vietnam. Certainly their language dialects are different, but did you, the American military always tried to make a very big point of how there's no, by the way, the British did this in India as well, there's no such nation as Vietnam. They're just, you know, many different regions and different peoples, and I wonder whether you have any reflection on national unity in Vietnam and
ethnic identity. After the fact, after coming here and back here and then going on and doing the work that I've done with refugees, it became much more apparent, the regionalism became much more apparent here, where I was trying to train refugees to be counselors to other refugees, and in this paraprofessional mental health role, and clients from the South working with northern counselors, men working with women counselors. I mean, all of the things that you don't really think about so much within our framework became big issues. Here, and regionalism was one of them. Southerners working with Northerners, dialects that were different. People from Hue who have their own particular haughtiness about or xenophobia about being from Hue, what that means within the historical context of Vietnam is the imperial, old imperial seat, how much superior they felt to people, and because of the intellectual traditions of the not just the university, but the high schools there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have as much of a sense of it in 1966 as a 21, 22-year-old flying around doing this.
Same thing would probably also apply to Buddhist revolts. Anti-government demonstrations.
No, it was a very, to me it was something that went on. The immolations that were occurring prior to my getting there, things of that sort. That was, under Diem in 63. I was a pretty out of touch and politically unsophisticated young man. I, in some ways, still am in politically unsophisticated, but it's not something that I really resonated to. I think it would be fair to say, about my experience, I don't know about the rest of the group that I was with, but my experience is that I sort of came, and I described myself, I think, accurately, idealistic, chauvinistic, very naive. I think within 2 years of my being there, the naivete was gone. The idealism still remained somewhat, but not so much for Vietnam, but at least in terms of doing things for people or trying to work with people. And probably some of the chauvinism stayed. But I think I sensed a difference in the IVSers that came even in 66, but certainly in 67, much more politically astute and aware than I felt my group was. I mean, when I think about Bob Hargraves and Bob Levy and Hugh Swift and myself, I don't think about a group that sat around talking about the politics of the war so much or the situation there. Somewhat, but not intensely. I think 2 years later there was a much different breed of IVSer that had been shaped in part by the experience of this country bifurcating over Vietnam. People went there, I think, making much more informed political choices about what they were going there for and why they were doing it. I don't think that was the case in 64, which is when I would have made, as I said, would have made the decision to go there. So I don't, you know, when you talk about the Buddhist revolts, you know, I don't remember significant conflict about that when I was there. Vung Tau was like this little oasis in a way. And although I traveled pretty extensively and was in Saigon, Pete had died the first year. Pete had been killed the first year that I was there. And Max Sinkler was the other IVSer who died in the first year. He was German. And we dedicated the IVS annual report to him. I didn't have a team leader that replaced him. I mean, nobody came down to visit me in Vung Tau. So I was sort of off on my own, pretty independent in that way. And I had met at the end of my school year. I met a Vietnamese woman on the beach in Vung Tau. Her name was Ian, and we started talking. I used to go to the beach in the late afternoon sometimes and sit out there. And I had also made the acquaintance of a neighbor of mine who was French, born, now Canadian. And he was married to a Vietnamese. His name was Jacques Loriot. And Jacques and I have stayed in touch since Vietnam. Visited him. He was in charge of De Havilland, which is the aircraft group. And he had these incredible connections with a whole group of French people that were there, whom I got to know. Guy Picard, who was the manager of a bar in Saigon called Au Givral, which was right across from the Continental Hotel. And it's a pretty well-known watering spot for French expatriates and stuff. And I got to be really good friends with a whole group of these guys who thought I was crazy, just, you know, doing what I did.
How did you spell the name of the restaurant?
Au Givral?
Yeah.
G-I-V-R-A-L. Okay. A-U. Au Givral.
Okay. And it was...
The Continental Hotel was directly across the street from it, and it was kitty corner to the Caravelle.
Right. Okay. Hotel. I know where it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Guy had been a manager, a hotelier, they called them, of some place up in Hanoi. And then after 1954, right, moved south, and he managed this place.
And this is Picard, as in?
P-I-C-C or P-I-C-A-R-D.
A-R-D, yes, yeah. As in Jean-Luc, which is our students will know.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Guy was the former lightweight, bantamweight boxing champion of Normandy. I saw him in 1981 in Paris. It was Jacques Loriot. I went and saw Jacques and Madeau. They were living in London then. They live in Toronto now. I met Ian at the beach, and she had a boy with her named Jimmy, American, by a GI. But she wasn't working in a bar. I mean, she didn't, to my knowledge anyway, ever work in a bar. But she had this boy and a young woman named Tang, who was a little dull, and just, I guess we would call her slightly retarded, who took care of Jimmy and helped Ian. And Ian and I fell in love, and I moved out of the laundry. She was living in Saigon. She was just down there for weekends. So during the summer that I was in Saigon writing the IVS annual report, I lived with her in her apartment in Saigon. And actually met also a guy named Johnson, a special forces captain, a black guy, who was a Green Beret, out in Taining province, and got permission from Don Luce, actually, to fly out and visit him out there. I told Don about it, and I had been reading a lot of Joseph Conrad, and had this real thing about, little did I know, that Francis Coppola would do that. But I had this real issue about what it would be like to be under fire, not that you weren't in danger, but it kind of became an obsession with me. And I went out to visit Johnson in Tay Nang at the Special Forces at the B camp, and he was supposedly at an A team camp at a place called Tri B, and I went to visit there and stayed there overnight. He wasn't there. There was a Colonel Oakes that was in charge of that A team, and the camp got attacked by a very large contingent of Viet Cong. And a lot of the Oakes was calling in 155 millimeter artillery rounds, marching them closer to the camp. The Vietnamese commander came over and said, no, 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 they needed to go further out. And I remember very vividly Oakes laughing and saying, yes, of course, and then bringing them in even closer. And a lot of the rounds that came over the Special Forces group came from inside the camp. I mean, it was really quite an experience. And I didn't need to do that anymore after that night.
You were satiated from one experience.
Yeah, believe me. 155 millimeter rounds landing near you on the ground, picking you up, and, you know, and there's no place to go, you know. Incoming mortar rounds, you know, you have trenches you can go into, and, you know, I mean, it's, and I didn't want to carry a weapon. I wouldn't carry a weapon, which, but it sort of put me on the outs with IVS, I think, going out to do something like that. That wasn't what I was supposed to be there to do at all.
Well, to fulfill or work out a personal...
Which I think, you know, in retrospect, maybe a lot of people were there doing, but in different ways. I was there to teach English and to work for IVS and to work with youth, you know, youth groups and stuff, and to go out and test myself with the military particularly, you know, or people that I, you know, and then also to have this relationship with this Vietnamese woman. She moved back to Vung Tau with me, and we found an apartment and lived together for the next year. That wasn't, IVSer, I mean, if you think about Don Luce saying, you know, well, you shouldn't be in a house that's next door to three prostitutes, and then I end up living with a Vietnamese woman. Her son, and Tom lived with us too, the young woman. That I don't think was considered to be good IVS behavior. But that was my experience. Hugh used to come down and visit me, and Ian, and spend time. Carly Allender, who is now Carly Numi, N-U-M-I. I don't know if you
sounds familiar.
Interview her. Yeah, Carly Numi. N-U-M-I. Allender was her maiden name, and she was married to a guy who was the chief lawyer for the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund. Dave, he's here in the East Bay, he's in Berkeley.
She was married?
Yeah, they're
She's
divorced. I don't know, she may be married, but to someone else.
Right, right.
I want to say Dave Nemitz. I can look that up. But anyway, he is, I do know that he is, Nesbitt. Dave Nesbitt, N-E-S-B-I-T-T, I think it is. Or Nesmith. Nesbitt, I think it's Nesbitt.
Was he in IVS?
Yeah.
Were they?
They were married in IVS together, I'm pretty sure.
Now, this is the question, they were married?
I think they I don't know whether they met there and married or whether they were married before they came. I don't know. David Nesbitt or Nesmith?
Well, I can call. He's a lawyer. Call the Sierra Club.
He's a lawyer, and he's the head of their legal defense. Yeah.
But he might know where Carly is.
Carly went and headed up an IVS program recently, or it was IVS, in Hanoi, and then went with the American Friends Services Committee, and she was living in Pennsylvania. I may have her address.
Okay.
Yeah. And again, this file that's up there.
Which has, But Dave was in IVS as well.
Yeah, David Nesmith.
Yeah, because I could try to. Oh, it's too bad. I might have some time Tuesday or something.
Well, I don't know if he. I mean, maybe he didn't fill out the questionnaire.
Well, the problem is that a lot of people got the questionnaire but just didn't fill it out because they were just too busy.
Whatever. Yeah.
And some of them are just. We're getting. We also sent out postcards, as a double blind, just to make sure people knew about it. But some people are just sending, responding to the, these are self-addressed postcards. We just pop it back in the mail. Some people are just sending in those now, and they went out 2 months ago.
Yeah.
So The thing is that what I'm my rule of thumb is if someone else if another IVSer mentions their name, I will contact them and say, so and so mentioned your name. This is our project. Are you interested?
Chris Jenkins, do you have his
name? Oh, I'm seeing Chris tomorrow morning.
Okay, great. Yeah.
That was great because Jim Yoder gave me a telephone number for him that was out of date.
Oh, I've got
it. And I know, but the point is, it was some interesting detective work, and it all worked out in the end. It were very from one to another.
Tweet, Chris's wife, is Vietnamese, became a student of mine at UC Berkeley in the School of Social Welfare. Because after I worked with refugees for a number of years here, the School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley asked me to teach a course, which I did for 8 or 9 years, called Immigrants and Refugees in America, Social Policies and Clinical Issues. And Tweet was going for her MSW.
What would you spell her name for the
T-U-Y-E-T, Chris had gone to Taft, but we were never very close, and we still aren't really very close. And he's a good friend of David Morris. David is a closer friend of Chris's.
David Morris?
Marr.
Oh, David Marr. I'm sorry. No, yeah. We're talking about. Okay, sure. Well, that's good. I guess I'll ask Chris about that. Because, of course, I was weaned. That was the milk of my education, was David Elliott and David Marr. That's what you read.
Yeah.
There wasn't much
else.
If we pick up our story, we're in the summer of '66. You were editing the annual report, and you were finishing up the Volunteers in Vietnam.
Volunteers in Service to Vietnam, program. Yeah.
Program
for I-Corps and living with Ian in Saigon, and then I took a month's vacation toward the end of the summer time. Went to Laos, saw Lou Wolf, Thailand, visited people that I knew there. A fellow, he was actually the rector of Chula Longhorn Medical School, named Chartakavanish. Took a train down to Malaysia, was in Penang, went up to the Cameron Highlands, hitchhiked around up there in Haiti. I was by myself, I did that all. So I spent about a month alone traveling through those parts of Southeast Asia and then back to Vietnam again. The IVS, the editing of the report was done, it was printed, the program was done. So I went back to Vung Tau to teach.
And now with?
Ian came down and we found a place that actually another teacher from the high school, they owned this building. It was a rectangle with 9 small cells in it, and it was 3, 3, and 3. They had the bird into the window. They had the first 3. There were 3 prostitutes that had the middle 3, one in each room, and then I had the last 3, which was by the well and by the restroom. At that point, there were a lot more bars in Vung Tau, and a lot of American servicemen were coming there for R&R. And I remember very vividly having coffee in the kitchen area of the place that I lived, which was the third of the 3 rooms, and that was by the well and by the bathroom, and watching young Americans, 18, 19 years old, who they would see me sometimes, they'd come in and talk, and these were kids that just were experiencing war, and I remember some of these kids. One guy had lost all of his buddies in a mine incident. He was the only survivor. He'd smoke these cigarettes down until his flesh on his fingers, you could smell it, and he'd just light up another one and do it. And he kept saying to me over and over about this girl next door, you know, and I knew the girls that worked next door. He said, do you think she loves me? Think she loves me? I mean, he was just, it was really poignant. It was very sad to see these guys. And the girls were nice girls. I mean, they were just, you know,
they were working girls, and very nice and polite and it was quite a quite a deal. And what else was going on? I was doing a lot of work with a guy named Fong, who was the director of youth activities, organizing cookouts and picnics and things like that for youth groups. And I decided to study Taekwondo, or Thai Cuoc Dao, which is the Vietnamese for it. And there were a couple of Vietnamese instructors and then a whole group of Koreans that taught it. And there was a Korean military group that was down there. And when you talk about, before you mentioned that there was a bunch of training centers in Vung Tau, there was one particular one that was for what's called Kanbo, Saizuk Nom Thom, which were these cadres, these rural development cadres, which I think, I don't know the details of it, but it was like, I think these people were being trained by one of our intelligence groups to go out and do work in the villages. And mm-hmm. it was further up the coast, but there was one guy that I used to see periodically, because I used to wear the Al Baba, the black pajamas, mm-hmm. periodically. I had different pairs of black pajamas. I never taught in that, because I taught with a white shirt. And, mm-hmm. But on the weekends and stuff, I would wear that. And I saw this guy periodically on flights up to Saigon. He always wore black pajamas. He spoke beautiful Vietnamese, American, but mm-hmm. And he was with this training center, mm-hmm. Cat Lo, I think it was called. I don't know what they did up there. That was another sort of aside. I was in one of the towns was called Berea or Phuc Thuy. There was an IVSer who came to Berea, and I befriended him or tried to befriend him, and he decided to cut his tour short. He just wasn't happy mm-hmm. over there. He went back to the United States and stayed 7 or 8 months, I guess.
That town was Berea?
Yeah, that was the province, B-A-R-I-A, oh, okay. Berea.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I thought you said...
Or Phuc Thuy.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was another funny coincidence. I was riding my scooter back from Berea one day, and there was a naval base where they had these what were called swift boats mm-hmm. that would patrol the rivers. And this American walked out into the street, just oblivious. And I almost hit him. I had to avoid him.
Mm-hmm.
And I turned around. I had black pajamas on to go back. I was just so pissed off at him. And I went back and started yelling at him. And I looked at the guy, and I used to hunt with him at college. He had been in the same dormitory I was in my freshman year. He'd graduated a couple years ahead of me. And here was a Navy swift boat captain in Vietnam. We got together a few times and had beers. And
why was he wandering in the street?
Because it was right across from his base, and yeah. he was walking across the street. I mean, he just wasn't paying attention to where he was going. He just walked out into the street, and I was just this... he saw me, I'm sure, as a Vietnamese person coming down the street in a motor scooter, because I had on my black pajamas, right. and just... I used to get mistaken sometimes for what they call Phap Lai, which means half French, half Vietnamese, because mm-hmm. I would be... I didn't have a mustache. I had right. dark hair. I, more hair, and I got very tan. And speaking Vietnamese, and I would just, they thought I was, half French, half Vietnamese, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it was sort of weird running into him over there.
And you had dinner with him?
I had dinner with him a few times.
Did you ever talk about his experiences too?
He took me out on his swift boat. To just go out and see what that was like one night. Mm-hmm. Again, sort of looking around and seeing what these guys did. And mm-hmm. He chased down some junk and thought that they were searching for weapons and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it was. He talked a little bit about it. They would just patrol the river and then out onto the South China Sea to see mm-hmm. if there were arms that were being brought in. Mm-hmm. Nothing specific that I, know.
Oh, no, more about him and his reflections.
Not so much.
Were you looking at him?
Also? Well, he was, his father, his name is Bass, Alex Bass, and his father was Perkins Bass, and I think he was a senator from New Hampshire in the 50s or something like that. And,
Yeah, Alex, I think, was there to fight a war, and it was part of what his family sort of expected someone from his background to do. I think he was doing what was expected of him. And he had no sense or sensitivity to the people who were there. They were pretty foreign, totally foreign to him, and he viewed them in a fairly depreciating manner. And we don't—I mean, we didn't connect really very well.
Well, the you've raised an issue which, unfortunately, I haven't explored enough before. But how the U.S. military as individuals, not the U.S. military, but the U.S. military as individuals, looked at IVSers. IVSers are fairly frank. You know, I mean, I've been asking IVSers about how you related to the military around you. You've been talking a little bit about that. But there was a story where one of them was just walking along the road as a column went by, and they yelled out to him, "Hey, guy, get a gun." And he said, "I'll carry a gun." And they all laughed. You know, they couldn't believe that. And they said, "How long are you here?" When they told him what an IVSer was. And he said, 2 years. And they couldn't believe that. Mm-hmm. They couldn't believe that someone would voluntarily be in that country for 2 years. You know, one tour of, you know, 1 year. Yeah. They're all counting the days in which they could get out. And I've yet to encounter an IVSer who was counting the days until their contract was up. That doesn't mean there are a lot of people who weren't happy to leave when their contract was over.
Right.
And some, as you've mentioned, you know, terminated.
Well, he ended soon. And I think Marty Sisk, the guy who came with us, I think he did decide to do something with a weapon. I mean, I heard that. I never saw him again after our training. Bob Hargraves might know. I mean, if you go back to Bob.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can always call him and ask him. There was an IVSer who kind of winged it in Northern Laos, and against IVS kind of policy, would, you know, make parachute jumps from airplanes, and they said, you know, that was really unacceptable behavior. the point is, I always like to say that statistically, you're going to get all kinds out of a large number of people.
Oh, yeah.
So that's not that good.
Well, I had some interesting relationships with military people. There were Jacques Loriot entertained a lot at his place, a lot of military types who flew the Caribous. Vungtau was a Caribou base. There was also a signal intelligence group that was there, and there was a chaplain that I met named Eisenhower, who befriended me and who would periodically take me to dinner. He was a very bright, very articulate guy, very well read. He and I corresponded for years after Vietnam, and he introduced me to one of my best friends, a young man who is now at the University of Southern Idaho, in charge of their foreign student program, who has a PhD in theology from Berkeley, who I introduced to Hugh, my other, you know, and who traveled with Hugh. When he came back, had a lot of trouble sort of fitting back in, and he became a really famous, well-known trekker and leader of treks to the Himalayas, published several books about that.
His name sounded familiar, but I thought it might have been because
of
IBS.
A lot of photographs for National Geographic. Wally, this other friend, was a friend of Ike's, Eisenhower's. I saw the chaplain when he came back to the United States, saw him in Las Vegas, where he was subsequently stationed at the Nevada test site. He got out of the Army. I saw him after that. And then he died in a motorcycle accident. There was another military guy that I knew that was there named Keo, Major Keo, who was in charge of the Caribou group. And he would periodically call me up and offer to take me on flights, which I did. We flew over Dot Pak and Dot Silk, which were special forces camps at one point, making deliveries of food to these camps, pushing them out of the back of the planes on pallets. Then I remember once he took me up to see the Hello Dolly show, which was a USO show. And he had the press on board, and he couldn't officially take me along. And I remember he said, "You just tell him you're with a news agency." So I said I was with VSI, I thought IVS, VSI, you know. And this was Vietnamese News Service International. And I ended up in this briefing room where they were giving some thing briefing about this big operation that they just started, you know. Of course, I didn't have a pad, I didn't have a pencil. You know, I'm sitting in the front row and there's this general that's giving this thing, you know, and I'm trying to think about what to do. And I remember thinking, well, I'll try and act intelligent about this. And I said, could you spell that again? You know, and I sort of looked and I went over in my mind. And it was just, and KO, you know, said, don't worry about it. You know, he let me fly the plane back down to Vung Tau. I mean, he was in the cockpit, but he said, we're going to do this. And it's just, I mean, you know, it's a funny situation when you're in a war. There's so many, there just aren't rules that apply here that we live by all the time. And so there's a much more latitude for experience, and depending on the degree to which you're willing to allow yourself to go in different directions, you can